From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Most documentaries include archival footage, but in Stanley Nelson's film about the Black Panther Party, the footage itself is a character. And it wasn't enough to find footage from news reports. Nelson found that those were mostly distorted images of black men consumed with anger, prone to violence. The footage Nelson found and used showed the Black Panther Party movement as something more complex. The militant rhetoric was part of getting the country's attention, but he also found images of Panthers working in communities, offering health care and free meals. The story is tumultuous, to be sure, and there are moments of violence, but Nelson says at the heart of all of this isn't rage, but love. Stanley Nelson will join us to talk about the film after the news.
On the next More to Say, the story of Madison Jensen.
She was the one that whatever Dad wanted to do, she was in your back pocket. Whenever we would go duck hunting, fishing, she was going.
Madison died in a Utah jail. In fact, more inmates die in Utah jails than any other state. KUER's Whitney Evans has been trying to find out why. Download the story now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had with a documentary filmmaker, Stanley Nelson. This was at the Sundance Film Festival back in 2015. In his film about the Black Panther Party, Nelson tries to give a sense of what it has meant to be black in America. And he does it by exploring how the Black Panthers emerged out of the tumult of the 1960s. The party gave many African Americans a new voice and a new posture. Nelson has said he doesn't want his film to be just another thought-provoking observation about the past, because when you're talking about race relations in this country, there are just too many parallels between that time and today to ignore. Nelson's documentary is called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, and it's currently showing on Netflix. Stanley Nelson, good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to—I mean, you've been working on this piece for at least 7 years, I guess.
Right.
What was the thing that got you started on it? Do you remember the kernel of the idea at first?
Well, you know, I was a 15-year-old kid when the Panthers started in 1966, so I just gave away my age, if you can add. So I was a kid, and I was living in New York, and I was just, like so many other people, you know, fascinated by the Panthers and enamored by the Panthers.
And you thought they were cool and they dressed cool?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know, the civil rights movement before that, you know, it was Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy in suits and ties. And here was guys in black leather jackets with big afros and sunglasses and berets. And I was like, wow, you know, these guys really look cool. And they also sounded cool. There was something different about them. They were in your face, you know. And so it was very different. Also, they were talking about the problems that I knew about, you know, police brutality, you know, housing, you know, bad food, you know, all those things that we had, you know, in the North, the Panthers were talking about. So I was always fascinated by them. And, you know, as I became a filmmaker, it was something that was always in the back of my mind. You know, how can I make a film about the Panthers? Mm. And so about 7 years ago, we wrote the first proposal. It was kind of like after, you know, as my career progressed, I was like, well, you know, let me try to do something that I really want to do, you know, that's really close to my heart. And it took a while to get the funding. But we finally did. We had some courageous funders. And here we are.
Yeah. I wonder if as you kept digging and digging and digging into it, did you realize how – because this is actually a theme in the film, how complicated the story is, how complex it is.
Yeah, we knew from the very beginning as we got into the story that this was not a simple story, because the Panthers evolved as they went along. So there were different phases of who the Panthers were. You know, they started out as, you know, five or six guys in Oakland, California policing the police, following the police around. And it evolved into a national movement. And then, you know, the leaders would get put in jail. You know, Huey was in jail for a long period of time. Eldridge Cleaver goes to Algeria. So, you know, the Panthers were not one thing. They really changed over time. And that was something that we wanted to show in the film. Although they only really lasted, their heyday was 7 years.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. One of the things you've talked about is that And I mentioned this actually in the introduction before, that when you look at archival, like if you just looked at news footage of the Black Panthers, you'd get one impression of them. You know, really angry black men who were prone to violence and they were scary looking. But you didn't want that. I mean, you wanted to go deeper. And so the archival footage that you found, which is remarkable, gives you another sense. So there's this kind of, I think you put it this way, there's been this kind of oversimplified impression of what the Black Panthers were.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because part of that oversimplification has come over time.
Yeah.
So I think at the time, the Panthers were looked at very differently. Yeah. So there were people, you know, without a doubt, who were scared out of their minds by these guys. But there were other people who loved the Panthers and you know, really wanted to support the Panthers. And that's not only African-Americans, but that, as you see in the film, you know, are white people, Asians, rich, poor, you know, young, old. And all of them, you know, became Panther supporters. And I think that's really an important piece of history that's been lost and that we wanted to talk about within this film.
Let's set the time. 66, as you said. Claiborne Carson, one of the historians you have, mentions. In fact, we'll hear from Elaine Brown also here in this clip. So I want to play a clip. Because the setting, I guess, Stanley, is that this was a time of revolution. You had 50 countries, as you point out in the film, that had gained their independence, as Claiborne says in this clip, before the founding of the Black Panther Party. I mean, so there was something in the air.
Yeah, I think that that's really important to understand. You know, I was around at that time, and you know, so many people really felt that this was not only a revolutionary time around the world, but we were in the midst of a revolution here in the United States.
Yeah.
And people really, really believed that.
Here's a clip. Claiborne Carson, you'll hear again, and Elaine Brown from Stanley Nelson's new film, The Black Panthers, Vanguards of the Revolution.
This was a revolutionary time. 50 countries in the world gained their independence in the decade before the founding of the Black Panther Party. This is the time when people are getting drafted to go and fight in Vietnam. So if somebody's coming and saying, well, if you're going to fight, why not fight right here in L.A. or Oakland? You know, that made a lot of sense.
You couldn't be absent and see what we saw. We couldn't unsee it. I was a cocktail waitress in a white strip club 2 years before I joined the Black Panther Party. How did that happen? The rage was in the streets. It was everywhere.
You know, one of the things you can't escape is the comparison with today.
Right.
Obviously, you couldn't have anticipated it, but it's the most relevant thing in terms of social conversations right now, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just this amazing thing that's happening in this country, and it's an amazing thing that's happening for the film. I mean, that, you know, once again, we're talking about police brutality, and that's how the Panthers started. They started because of police brutality in Oakland, California, and then they took off around the country because so many young black people joined all over the country because they had the same kind of brutalizing experiences with their local police. That's how they started. They started as an antidote, hopefully to the police. And here we are 50 years later, we're talking about the same thing.
It's so interesting because it seems like the film is a history. So you're seeing these images from the past, but hearing them talk about people like in this clip, Jamal Joseph and William Calhoun and Wayne Farr talking about those times, you could really translate that to 2014, 2015. And it wouldn't be that different.
No, it's the exact same thing. I mean, you know, we'll hear the clip. It sounds like today. It's the exact same thing, and that's part of because you know a lot of the changes the Panthers were fighting for didn't happen. You know, I mean, if there was a revolution, you know, they lost.
People always talk about freedom and what that means. During that time period, being black in America meant that you didn't walk down the street with the same sense of safety and the same sense of privilege as a white person.
There was absolutely no difference in the way the police treated us in Mississippi than they did in California. They may not have called you nigger every day, but they treated you the same way they did in Mississippi.
Police jump on you, beat you up, put the gun at your head. This is what we were going through on a daily basis.
Do you think on some level, I think that's interesting you said that on some level, what's happening today in Ferguson and in Florida and New York is a result of the fact that they weren't able to settle that. And in fact, some of the response to it, which we'll get to, J. Edgar Hoover, for example, the FBI, law enforcement, their response to it, that's the context for today still. So it's still completely unresolved in some ways.
Yeah, I think that that's what happened was that, you know, the Panthers were demonized and the issues that they fought for were then ignored because they were demons. You know, they weren't normal people. But the issues have stayed there. And I think that, you know, especially the issue of police brutality, police have been allowed to not deal with it. To say we don't, this isn't true. You know, we're not going to deal with that. I hopefully, because of what's happening today, people they're going to have to deal with it,
yeah.
And that's really important. As I listened to those clips, it was really interesting because I was thinking, you know, that we finished filming a year ago. You know, some of those interviews were probably done, 2 years ago,
wow.
It wasn't like we took the what's going now and ran out and did some more interviews. No, those things were done, a year or two ago.
The film makes an important point about the founding of the Black Panthers, which, you know, as you said, it did not start as a national movement. It started one community, and it started with the idea, a couple of ideas, but one particular, and I want to mention it because it's such kind of an astounding story, and it's the idea of it being about self-defense. The Black Panthers carried guns.
Right.
And it was all really legal within the rights. I want to play this another clip here because this is Sherwin Fort. Is it Fort?
Forte.
Sherwin Forte was a Black Panther. You'll also hear, by the way, one of the Panther founders, Huey Newton, in some of this archival footage. Let me play this clip and have you talk about it.
Sure.
Because the imagery that you – it's amazing,
right.
I have to say. Here's another clip from Stanley Nelson's film.
Huey had studied the law. In Oakland at that particular time, anyone could carry a firearm who did not have a felony conviction at the time. The firearm could not be concealed. It had to be in the open.
The California Penal Code section 12020 through 12027 and also the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees the citizen a right to bear arms on public property.
Huey said, we're going to carry our guns and we're going to follow the police. And if they stop someone, we're going to stop, we're going to maintain a legal distance, and we're going to observe these so-called law officers in the performance of their duties.
And it's amazing because you see them, I mean, it looks kind of terrifying in the context
right.
of today, but it's really remarkable. And they would stay at distance, but they had guns, and this was about self-defense.
They had loaded weapons, and they would follow the police around and police the police. So when the police would jump out to make a stop or whatever their action was, the Panthers would jump out of their cars behind them, stay a safe distance behind, but with their guns drawn and try to make sure that no violence occurred. One of the interesting things that's happened here at Sundance after the screenings is that people have come up to me and said, wow, it's amazing that that happened. You know, was there violence? And I said, no, none of the patrolling the police actions resulted in violence. And what they said to me that was so remarkable was that you couldn't do that today.
Yeah.
You could not patrol the police today or there would be shootouts. So what does that say? That the police have gotten worse than they were 50 years ago? It's, and that's happened more than once at screenings here at Sundance.
I thought about also the context of, you see these white politicians trying to draft laws to limit the use of weapons.
Right.
That wouldn't happen today
right.
either. I mean, trying to put that in the context of the NRA today, it's but amazing.
Well, you know, I think it might happen today if you have a group of armed black men drawing weapons and riding around with weapons. And you know, so yes, I think that's, again, one of the things that's an echo of the past is that, you know, so many states are passing open carry laws that allow you to carry a gun again. You know, so it's there's so many kind of things that are happening with this film, you know, that were happening then that are still happening today. It's just it's amazing.
Here's another thing that I think may have gotten lost over time in terms of what the Black Panthers were all about. And it was that what they were asking for, they had this, I think it was this 10-point platform. Right. And there are a couple of times in the film where you really highlight what it was that they were asking for. So on one hand, they came across as angry and militant, but they were asking for some of the most basic things and some of the most basic rights.
Right. Right. And that was, you know, again, that was one of the ways that back then we knew the Panthers, yeah, because they had this 10-point platform and program that when you opened the paper, that was the first thing you saw. And it talked about, you know, decent housing, a decent education, an end to police brutality, stuff that made a lot of sense.
But that's gotten lost, right? I mean, again, I mean, I think, as you say, over time, they were in these communities. They were serving breakfast to kids, and they were doing health screenings. But I don't think anyone thinks about, at least today, who don't know anything or didn't know anything about the Black Panthers, only think about the one image of them. I think they lose track of that part.
Right. I think that one of the things that happens, and we'll probably talk about this a little later, is that movements and just things in general are remembered by how they end.
Yeah.
You know, they're not remembered by how they beginning or what was the middle, but how they ended is what we fixate on. And I think the way they started, what they wanted is very different than how they ended up.
It was about social issues. It was about economic opportunity. And it was also – here's another clip. William Calhoun talks about how they wanted average people,
right.
That it was fundamentally about a response to the way the economic system was, that it wasn't working for people, and not just black people, but obviously that was their focus. But, you know, the whole middle class, I think, is something really interesting. Phyllis Jackson is in this clip you'll hear. You'll hear from Elaine Brown, as I mentioned, William Calhoun, that really this was about dismantling a system.
Right. And I, you know, those clips I'm really proud of, and I'm really proud that we found a place for them, because they talk about, you know, the Panthers' kind of basic philosophy, which I think is really interesting. I mean, you know, they were socialists and they were. And you know, we spent a lot of time in the edit room debating that, you know, can we talk about, can we have them say that they're socialists? Because immediately people are like, oh, no. But, you know, I think as you'll hear in the clips, there was a rationalization for what they wanted and what they believed.
Our attack was not only against white supremacy, but it was also about capitalism. We actually thought that the way in which capitalism created a working class that was kept absolutely destitute, that was wrong.
So we took the position that in order for us to be free, that system had to be dismantled. We could not be free in a system that had oppressed us in the first place. So you have to get rid of that system.
We were not after the church folks. We were not after the Muslim folks. We wanted the brother on the corner. The brother was getting his head banged in every weekend by the police. We wanted the brother who was going to jail just snatched out of his car for a traffic ticket because he was black. That's who we were after.
And of course, the movement really, it catches on and it really starts to grow. And this is where you start to see the beginnings of, in some ways, you're also profiling the nature of any organization. On one hand, you have to get people's attention.
Right.
But then things get disorganized, and you know, it's this flux of an organization. It's really about that, too, I noticed, the film.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that happened to the Panthers, and they're clear about it in the film, former Panthers, is that it grew too fast.
Yeah.
You know, when people saw, you know, these black men with guns, I think one of the things that was calculated by the Panthers, and very calculated, very smart, was that the Panthers knew that certain people would be totally alienated by black men with guns. they would just be alienated by that. But on the other hand, there'd be a lot of people who would be like, wow, this is, you know, this is just what I want. And they didn't care about that. They weren't trying to get everybody. They were trying to get a certain group of people. And they did that. And it just grew. It exploded. It grew too fast in some ways. There was no screening process, as somebody says, you know, people just walked in off the street.
We didn't know anything about them.
Right, right. And you know, and as the film goes on, you know, we see what that led to, you know, being infiltrated and other things. But I think that they're very clear on, you know, you're in an organization and it explodes. You're really happy. What are you going to, you know, hey, we're catching on. But on the other hand, you know, you can catch on too fast.
Yeah. A lot of characters in here that are extraordinary. We'll talk about the particulars of a few. We should start with Huey Newton. The party visionary is how he's described. And everyone seemed to play a role in some ways. What's the part that Huey plays? I mean, he's passionate.
Yeah. Huey was, as you say, the visionary of the party. He was kind of the political force, the one who's intellectually driving the party. That was Huey. You know, a lot of the party was based, you know, on Huey's ideas, and that's how they came into being. So Huey is really the visionary, the intellectual basis of the party.
Bobby Seale, he's the personality.
Bobby Seale is a personality. Yeah. Bobby Seale, we really wanted to use this. There's a great clip that we just couldn't use where Bobby Seale talks about the fact that he was a former comedian, and the interviewer says, "Well, you know, what kind of jokes would you tell?" And he actually tells a joke, you know, but the joke was so long that we couldn't use it in the film. But you know, he was like a former comedian. He, you know, he was he had this just great personality. You know, people liked Bobby. He's also very, very forceful. You know, he's very forceful, but he was much more like down to earth than Huey. Huey was up, you know, up here intellectually. Bobby was on the ground, and you know, and everybody could identify with Bobby.
Yeah, Eldridge Cleaver. He's a character.
Eldridge Cleaver is a character.
And hard to control.
Yeah, Eldridge Cleaver is an uncontrollable human being. Eldridge Cleaver, you know, I'm not sure which clip you'll play, so I hope I'm not repeating
it. It's Filippi Luciano, but you can talk about it.
Eldridge Cleaver had a book, A Soul on Ice, which was on the bestseller list, in the New York Times bestseller list for weeks. I mean, it was at this time, it was on the bestseller list. He was in prison. He was a guy who was about 30 years old. He was a little bit older than everybody else because they were mostly teenagers. He had spent literally half his life in prison. So of the 30 years, 15 years of his life had been spent in prison, with all that comes with being, you know, in prison for that amount of time. He was,
which is candor and being really frank.
Well, as somebody said, you know, to us, and we weren't able to use this in the film, I think it might have not even somebody in the film, they said, you know, it takes a certain amount of bravado, a certain way of being, to be a top dog in prison. And Eldridge Cleaver was the top dog in prison. So he had all of that, but he was brilliant.
Yeah.
He was brilliant, and he could use words, and you know, he did not, I'm trying not to curse, he did not care what people thought. He just didn't. And so he could make the most outrageous statements that would get the crowd going crazy.
Yeah.
But sometimes it would take the crowd into a place that probably they shouldn't have gone.
Right. Well, here's an example. This is Filippi Luciano, the great poet and activist from the film. You'll also hear Eldridge himself saying those outrageous things that Stanley's mentioning. You'll hear Marvin X, too, another character in the film, writer in the film, from Stanley Nelson's film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution.
Eldridge had this incredible ability to encapsulate a thought in a few sentences and form it into an artistic statement that pointed right, that stabbed right into the heart of the enemy, and he did that all of the time. Now, was he always correct? No.
And I say that Ronald Reagan is a punk, a sissy, and a coward, and I challenge him to a duel. I challenge him to a duel. To the death, or until he says, Uncle Eldridge.
Was he insane? F*** yeah. That boy was crazy. And he got a lot of people hurt.
and I give him his choice of weapons. He could use a gun, a knife, a baseball bat, or a marshmallow, and I'll beat him to death with a marshmallow. That's how I feel about him, see?
That's it. They are not going to be able to control Eldridge. Eldridge was a Rottweiler, uncontrollable personality. Who could be in an organization with Eldridge and he not be the leader? Nobody. And that's basically how it ended up.
Which is true, right? I mean, it's on one hand that you need that passion to get people engaged, but it's like you're almost to the point where anything could go off the rails with him. And with certain leaders in that organization.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to be perfectly honest, you know, Huey was also a very volatile personality. And, you know, I mean, as I'm making the films, it also made me think about the fact that, you know, to be a leader, to be that kind of person, you have to be a little bit off in a way, you know? I mean, it's not the normal person, yeah. You know, who decides that they're going to police the police. It's not the normal person who's going to make a speech about, you know, beating Ronald Reagan to death, you know? I mean, and this is through, at that point, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. And this is a huge audience that he's speaking to. So, you know, all of the things that helped lead to the collapse of the party in terms of the personality and the personality conflicts were there from the beginning.
Stanley Nelson. He directed the documentary film Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It premiered at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. You can watch it on Netflix, and we have a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation with the filmmaker Stanley Nelson. We were talking about his film, Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It's part of Nelson's attempt to give a sense of what it is meant to be black in America. And the film explores how the Black Panther Party emerged during the tumult of the 1960s. The Black Panthers gave many African Americans a new voice and a new posture. But Nelson says the movement is often misperceived. Nelson's film about the Black Panthers is currently showing on Netflix. It premiered at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. So I wanted to ask you about, you were mentioning how when you were a kid, 15 years old, and the, you know, amazing hair, you know, great afros and the leather jackets. And I mean, they really looked cool. And it seems like the Black Panther Party gave, and I think it's mentioned this way in the film, gave black people a new posture, like a new awareness, swagger.
Right. Yeah, I mean, one thing that's really fascinating about this story is if you think about it, you know, until that time, you know, in 1966, basically African Americans were looked at in a very different way. You know, there was, you know, first we weren't covered in the media at all. You never saw a black person. And then it was the civil rights movement. So, you know, it was very kind of suits and ties, very church-based. Even, you know, Malcolm X wore a suit,
yeah,
you know,
and somber.
For most of his career. But the Panthers were very different. It was very cool. It was in your face. It was the first time that you saw, you know, black men talking back and black women talking back and saying, no, you know, we don't have to be subservient. We don't have to ask you for anything. You know, what we like to say is, you know, there would have been no hip hop without the Black Panthers. It's that whole attitude that the Panthers, you know, come with that really changed the way African Americans look at themselves and are looked at by the world.
Here's another clip. This is Jamal Joseph and Julian Bond. It's great to see Julian Bond. That he's being interviewed by this white reporter, and he's got an attitude.
Yeah, we love that clip. I mean, one of the things, we found this clip of Julian Bond, and we're like, where can we use this? How can we? Well, we got to use it somewhere. It's such a great piece.
The Panthers didn't invent the idea of black is beautiful. People had started wearing afros and dashikis. One of the things the Panthers did was that urban black is beautiful. And that look just blew people away.
If you were a young black man living in the city anywhere, you wanted to be like this. You wanted to dress like this. You wanted to act like this. You wanted to talk like this. You wanted to be this.
It's a standard of aggressiveness, of militance, of just forcefulness, that the sort of standard we haven't had in the past.
But figuratively speaking, you're not about to become a Panther.
No, not today or tomorrow at any rate. Maybe the day after.
Am I black enough for you? Am I black enough for you? Am I black enough for you? Am I black enough for you?
We sort of extended that little music section at the end because I did want that as a way to talk about the music, which plays, and we've been talking a little bit about the off the air. It really plays a role in the film. It has a character almost in the film.
Yeah, we really wanted the music to be front and center. You know, I mean, that was so much a part of the times. I mean, one of the things that goes without saying that's more subtle is that there was so much music at that time about black identity, about making change, you know, even about just loving each other. You know, there's a song that we use that called Black Is, you know. I mean, it's just we really just wanted that to be part of the film, to give a sense, to take you back to that time, because you can't understand the Black Panthers unless you can somehow get yourself back into that time, because we couldn't have anything like that today. I mean, the Panthers were such a media phenomena that, you know, you had the Panthers on TV every night talking about revolution.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, part of it was that the music on the radio was talking about revolution or talking about being black. And so we really wanted the music to play. And, you know, we made the decision to in the edit room to try to play the music as loud as we could.
Yeah, go for it.
So when we had to mix, I can't tell the mixer louder. Okay, get the music as loud as we possibly can without you know, kind of, you know, breaking the FCC rules or whatever it is.
Right.
So they say, okay, you have to turn the whole film down, but just pump the music up so that it really, you really can feel it, and it really becomes part of a character in the film.
Well, it also gets to the fact, and this is an important, I think, idea in the film, that these were, for the most part, young people.
Right. And that's central, because something about, you know, when you see people in clips, you know, you always think they're older than they are. I don't know why. You know, Martin Luther King was very young when he passed, but he always looks like kind of an elder statesman. They were really young. I mean, you know, probably the median age of the Panthers was under 20. You know, Kathleen Cleaver, who's in the film and was here with us at Sundance at the first few screenings, was 22.
Yeah.
And she was like kind of one of the, you know, responsible older people. You know, they were young. They were teenagers. And so it was really important for us to make that point that these people, and that's also part of the problem.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
They're teenagers. They're making this stuff up as they go along. You know, it started out again as six guys patrolling the police, this wild idea. And now they have this national organization and they're kids and they're trying to figure out, you know, what's going on and what to do. And they're just winging it.
You have let me play a clip with Kathleen Cleaver, because she talks about the youth. And then we also get to hear, and this is an element that you used in the film, is these letters written by young people,
right,
to Huey, I guess it was, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we'll also hear, so you'll hear a letter there, and then also the terrific Rita Williams Garcia from Stanley Nelson's new film.
You're talking about people who are teenagers. 17, 18, 19, 20. That's the bulk of the Panthers are teenagers. So the fact that we were so young and the fact that this hadn't happened before, I'm not certain that we recognize how startling it looked to other people.
Dear Mr. Newton, I'm a 13-year-old black girl and I want to be a Black Panther. I wish you would fill me in. Does it matter what your religion is? What are some qualifications to be a Black Panther? P.S. Write me back personally.
I was taught to be proper. Behave yourself, you going out in public, to always know that the white man was listening. With the Black Panthers coming to the scene, it was just a completely different message. As a 12-year-old, you know, what? You had this whole other portrayal of self and just digging it.
The photographers took advantage. I mean, they took our pictures, they put them on newspapers, they put them on magazines, and that look that we projected, you know, the big afro, the leather jacket, the shades, that became a hit.
We'll come back to this point again, but I wanted you to talk about which seemed to be one of the central themes, I think, of the film. At least the sense that I got from you was that this idea, when you think about the breakfast program and you think about the paper that they produced, that it wasn't about militancy, it wasn't about rage. I mean, that was something that drove it. But you say the core driver, I think that's the words you use, is that it was about love.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the slogans of the Panthers, one of the things they always say. I went to a kind of a reunion of the Panthers in just researching this film, and Jamal Joseph, who's a former Panther, got up and he said, this is how he said it, you know, what was the driving belief of the Panthers? 1, 2, 3. And everybody screamed, a love of the people. And, you know, and I just always remembered that and always felt that it was really central that we at least make that point. So that's the central piece of it. And then the other thing, you know, you police the police because of the love of the people. You serve breakfast for children because of this love of the people. And then it's important that we understand that at least to the Panthers, they saw what they were doing as being driven from this core of love. You know, was it always expressed that way? No. Yeah. You know, and could you possibly be scared of the Panthers? Yeah, I understand that. You know, but that was you know, to them the driving force.
That's Stanley Nelson. He directed the documentary film Black Panthers: Vanguard of the Revolution. We spoke with him back in 2015 when his film was at the Sundance Film Festival. You can see it on Netflix, and we have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Stanley Nelson. We were speaking with him back in 2015 about his film Black Panthers: Vanguard of the Revolution. Well, the film takes a turn. I mean, it's like these social programs that the Black Panther Party is engaged in. I mean, they're starting to put aside that kind of militant reputation from the past. And then all of a sudden, J. Edgar Hoover steps into the picture, and he starts this program, this co-IntelPro, where he's seeing the Black Panthers as a black nationalist organization. Talk about how the story starts to turn with this part.
Well, you know, the Panthers become this media phenomena that, you know, everybody knows about the Black Panthers. It's a big deal. And J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, takes notice. Yeah. You know, it has to be said that J. Edgar Hoover had a special place in his heart for African Americans. He hated them.
I was going to say, where are you going? Yeah.
And he did. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, and he hated black people. And he thought that, you know, any change, I mean, it wasn't only black people, but any change in America was bad.
Yeah.
That his job was to just keep America where it was, you know, when he grew up in the 1917s or 10s or something, whatever that was. So this was J. Edgar Hoover. He notices the Black Panthers. They become on it. They come on his radar, and you know he has this thing called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, that's completely secret. Nobody knows about it except the FBI. You know, nobody knows about it, and they become the main focus of COINTELPRO. And he's doing everything he possibly can to destroy the Panthers. And one of the great things about it, for us as filmmakers, is that all that stuff is documented, and all those documents you can get released at this point. And so it's not some conjecture. You know, there's a lot of rumor, you know, that goes around. This is not rumor. And in the film,
we see the documents.
You see the actual documents where he talks about destroying the Panthers, and you know, through basically he says, you know, do whatever you want to the FBI agents.
Just and don't be creative.
Be creative. Yeah. Be creative in what you do to destroy the Panthers. Just don't let it get back to that it's the FBI who's doing it. So you have this huge agency that's trying to destroy the Panthers, that's able, you know, to infiltrate the Panthers. You can't even call it infiltrate, because all you had to do was walk into the office and say, I want to join. And, you know, and you could be an FBI agent, you know. And so every office in the country is infiltrated. Their phones are all tapped, and they're using any kind of dirty trick that they can find to destroy the Panthers from within. And they're also pitting the police against the Panthers from without. So there's this enormous pressure on the Black Panther Party. And it's totally secret. Nobody knows that this is what's happening.
Here's another clip from the film. The historian Scott Brown is in this clip, and you'll also hear from Erica Huggins, she was a Black Panther too, talking about this FBI strategy.
FBI has a memo that states the objectives of counterintelligence operations. One is to prevent the rise of what they call the Black Messiah, a single charismatic leader that could unify the movement. They wanted to prevent the appeal of radical political movement to Black youth. And they wanted to isolate these groups to prevent them from gaining respectability in the Black community. And they were very explicit in stating these goals.
We were followed every day. We were harassed. Our phones were tapped. Our families were harassed. My parents were both visited by the FBI.
What was the effect of that? Because in many ways, and the film sort of comes to this, sort of explores what effect all of this had, but it kind of worked.
It did work. I mean, you know, the Panthers became a very paranoid organization. You know, they would write letters, you know, to Huey, supposedly from Eldridge Cleaver, but they were really from the FBI. They would do the same thing going the other way around. So, you know, nobody knew who to trust. Nobody knew what to trust. And again, because this program was secret, nobody knew exactly what was happening to them, you know. But you know, and again, Hoover says, you know, do anything you want. Be creative. So they came up with crazy stuff that they did, you know, to pit the Panthers against each other, you know, internally. And also, you talk about teenagers again. Yeah. So these guys are really, really young. There's never been a program in this country up to that point that's been exposed that was anything like that. No, who would think that the FBI, you know, is writing letters to, you know, your wife, you know, saying, you know, you're cheating on her and stuff like that. That's what they were doing. So it had an effect on the Panther Party.
One of the things that happens over the course of all of this is that the rhetoric got really nasty, and it didn't help.
No.
When they started referring to the cops as pigs.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, because this is one of the things that sort of goes out of control a bit.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that happens to the Panthers is you know, they try to move away a little bit from the more militant piece. Hoover attacks them, so they regroup and become just as militant as they were before. You know, the rhetoric rises, and I think that's and that's something that just happened. How do you go away from this rhetoric that in some ways has attracted your members?
Yeah,
you know, that's what they were attracted to, and so one of the things that happens is it keeps escalating.
Yeah.
So instead of being able to pull back on the rhetoric, you know, how do you draw attention to yourself? And the Panthers were really good at that and wanted to do that. So how do you draw attention to that? Well, you know, in 1967, you talk about, you know, beating Ronald Reagan to death with a marshmallow. You know, in 1968, 69, you have to go beyond that and say something more outrageous so the news will notice you. And I think it heightens the rhetoric at a time when probably it would have been better for them to kind of lower the rhetoric.
Well, you see these young kids saying, take up the gun, and
right.
You say, off the pigs.
Right.
And I mean, it got really intense. And there's a great moment from the film. You hear from, this is a white law enforcement officer. I guess he's still with the LAPD, formerly anyway, Pat McKinley.
Yeah, he's retired.
You'll hear Howard Safford, another another voice here, Claiborne Carson, you'll hear as well. You'll hear Eldridge in this clip as well, talking about the as you say, the rhetoric, which really got amped up.
I was a sergeant patrolling in the projects, and there was a cutest little girl. So I stopped to say hello, and I said, "Hi, honey, how are you doing today?" And she looked at me and she said, "F you, pig." And I thought, we have lost it, man. We have flat lost it.
Anybody that criticized the police, especially that didn't have fear of saying it publicly, made the police angry. It was us against them. That became the theme.
We have seen the pigs on the scene. We know what he's like. We know what he's capable of. Just being a damn pig, oinking and beating, and walking the street.
The police must be brought under control by any means necessary, including through force of arms. These racist Gestapo pigs have to stop brutalizing our community, or we're going to take up guns, we're going to drive them out.
That tendency to keep escalating the rhetoric, that was a major part of the growth of the party, but it was also a destructive force because you were always up in the ante. Brought all the repression down on them before they were prepared to handle it.
I just want to deal with black and black liberation. My scene is picking up my damn gun, and I'm a mother. Have my baby in one hand, my gun in the other, and then I'm here, mother, to get what's mine.
It's really honest, this stuff. I mean, it's really intense, some of these scenes in this film.
Well, it was an intense time, yeah. And you know, part of, I think, you know, what Claiborne Carson is talking about there is the Panthers' ability, and also it became a need to kind of, you know, keep this intensity going and to keep raising the intensity. And as he says in that clip, it became probably a destructive force.
There are, as I said, there are a lot of remarkable, charismatic characters. One that I have to say I didn't know about, Fred Hampton.
Yeah.
And this was one of the things, I mean, J. Edgar Hoover's talking about a black messiah who's going to come. He's worried about, you know, what kind of a force they're going to be. Talk a little bit about Fred Hampton and his story, because he seemed so gifted.
Yeah, Fred Hampton, you know, was probably the one. You know, he was 20 years old. He was the head of the Chicago Black Panther Party. He had been head of the NAACP youth group in Chicago. His parents were churchgoers. He was a church member. You know, he had all those things. And he really was preaching unity. And it was also, it was based in the fact that, you know, as poor people, you know, we are oppressed across the board. And there's something common that we have as poor people. And the only way things are going to change is if we stop talking about race and unite as poor people. And he was actually doing that in Chicago. And it was working. I mean, you know, it was working.
I mean, he gets a man from Appalachia, so-called hillbilly there. So he's talking about white people coming together and Latinos coming together and Asian people coming together. I mean, that was a really interesting moment.
And the guy from Appalachia says, you know, I'll stick with the Black Panthers if the Black Panthers will stick with me. And I know they will. I mean, and this is in a film clip that we found, you know. And so this was Fred Hampton. He was a little bit different than Eldridge and Huey. You know, it was not so much about rhetoric, but it was actually about creating a unified force that was it was actually they called it the Rainbow Coalition,
right.
You know, before Jesse Jackson.
And I think in some ways it's one of the tragedies of the movement that he was killed.
Yeah, I mean, he was murdered by the Chicago police with the FBI's help. You know, one of the things that we talk about in the film a little bit is the FBI would arrange for the Panthers to get guns and then tell the local police they had them and encourage the police to raid the Panthers. And, you know, it's very clear in the film that Fred Hampton was murdered by the police.
Claiborne Carson says in the film that seems like one of the tragedies maybe, or one of the cautionary lessons for the Black Panther, was that they, at times, the party had leaders who weren't worthy of the followers.
Yeah, I think that that's what how it devolves finally into the end. You know, that there's this thing that they call the rank and file, which was the general members who didn't have any kind of big position, and those were the workers, those were the people, the true believers, those were what the Panthers were made out of. And by the end, Eldridge and Huey are battling each other, and it just goes crazy. And As Claiborne Carson says, the general rank and file, these people who had given up their lives to be part of the Panthers, didn't have leadership that was any good.
Yeah. Let me play one final clip. This is William Calhoun. I'm talking about, I think it's something you've been talking about throughout, Stanley, is that the strength of the movement could also be the weakness of the movement. Here's William Calhoun.
The great strength of the Black Panther Party was its ideals and its youthful vigor and enthusiasm. The great weakness of the party was its ideals and its youthful vigor and its enthusiasm. That sometimes can be very dangerous, especially when you're up against the United States government.
Just like sitting at the stagger on the coastline, living in a nation.
Stanley, let me ask you, what remains of the Black Panthers today? What's the legacy today? What's left?
Well, the Panther Party, the Black Panther Party, there does not remain. There is no Black Panther Party anymore. But I think I hope that the legacy of the movement is that these were young people who felt that they could change the country, and that they got together and that they tried. They, as someone says, I think it's right after Calhoun, we made mistakes. Of course they made mistakes, but they were young people who said, we have the power to make change. And I hope, hopefully that's the lesson of the Panther Party.
Stanley Nelson, director of the documentary film The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. Stanley, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.